My guest today, Grant Smith, is by now familiar with Takes on the World listeners, but just to bring you up to date, he's the director of IRMAP, the Washington-based Institute for Research in Middle Eastern Policy, the most indefatigable investigator and historian of the pro-Israel lobby, which is why you'll never hear him on the mainstream media. He has authored a number of books which should be required reading for anyone wishing to understand the enormous power wielded by Israel and its supporters in the U.S., and one of them, his latest, Big Israel, is now, he describes how Israel lobby moves America, is now out in paperback. All of them can be found, as well as a treasure trove of information on the Israel lobby, by going to his website, irmep.org. Each spring, IRMAP co-hosts a major conference on the Israel lobby at the National Press Club in Washington, with a Washington Report on the Middle East affairs that features major speakers from the political, academic, and journalistic world who have had the temerity to recognize the Israel lobby for what it is and to speak about it. While the media routinely ignores it, the lobby being a taboo subject, C-SPAN has covered them. Videos from those conferences can be also found on the IRMAP website.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Well, you know, when I saw Adam Entis's essay, it was surprised to me on how the last four U.S. presidents have been obligated by Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu to sign a letter committing themselves and their administrations to say and do nothing about Israel's nuclear weapons. I immediately realized that what was missing from the story, and immediately thought of you, is exposing Israel's nuclear weapons has been near the top of your agenda. Your article for antiwar.com, Four Presidents Conspire to Give $100 billion to Israel, Secret White House Letters Buttress Ongoing U.S. Arms Export Control Act Violations, told me what was absent from New York's story. Let's tell us about that.
Sure. I wrote that piece because, like you, I understood immediately that there's no doubt that these letters exist, that there has been a bipartisan effort whereby Israel's lobby, Israel, and the U.S. government work against both the national interest and simply break the law with impunity. And so the two things left out of the Entis article, which is great, and everyone should read that New Yorker piece, are, well, why are they doing this? Why would they go to all of this trouble and be in such a hurry to get to the president upon entry to office? And second, what is it that they're trying to hide in terms of some of the revelations made in the article, which is that Israel actually had nuclear weapons by the 1967 Six-Day War, which basically redrew the map of the Middle East. And so the article at antiwar.com simply goes into what is supposed to be U.S. law. There is a section of the Arms Export Control Act, which was originally part of the Foreign Assistance Act, which says very clearly that any state that has nuclear reprocessing technology transfers, is illegally importing material, know-how, technology for nuclear weapons, any country that's testing nuclear devices cannot be the recipient of U.S. aid. And there were two senators, Stuart Symington and John Glenn, who were behind these amendments to the Foreign Assistance Act, what is now the Arms Export Control Act, saying that only if a president makes a public case to Congress about why it's in the national interest to fund with massive foreign aid any proliferator, can that be waived and can it actually go through. In communications with Eleanor Holmes Norton, the non-voting D.C. representative, we discovered that no president has ever complied with that aspect of the law, the waiver aspect. And instead, since the law went into effect, making it, again, illegal to transfer U.S. foreign aid to such countries, there's been a $222.8 billion transfer of U.S. aid to Israel, at least what's not in black budgets. It's actually probably much more. And since Bill Clinton started signing these secret letters, it's grown to a very round number of $100 billion, $99.9 billion. And so the attempt in the article was to put some figures around the actual cost of simply subverting and pretending that the Arms Export Control Act law does not exist.
Well, it's ironic that Netanyahu is the one who insisted that these letters be written, because as the FBI inadvertently revealed, and you published, but the mainstream media looked the other way, that Netanyahu was on the Israeli end back in the mid-'80s of receiving stolen illegal nuclear chitons or nuclear triggers from the United States to use in their nuclear weapons, and his name improbably was not redacted by the FBI documents that you have on your website. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. It is ironic that Netanyahu is involved in so many aspects of this, but Arnon Milchan, the Israeli film producer who works out of Hollywood, set up on behalf of the Israeli Ministry of Defense an entire archipelago of companies to smuggle material from the United States that the Ministry of Defense wanted, and some of those items were Krytrons, nuclear triggers, and they shipped 700 of those out of the country. We managed to get all of the files, the most recent ones last year, from the Department of Homeland Security, outlining how they did it, and it turns out Benjamin Netanyahu was working at Helai Trading Company during the smuggling operation called Project Pinto, and he was actually working with Richard Kelly Smythe, the lower echelon person involved in the smuggling ring, who was actually indicted and prosecuted. And Richard Kelly Smythe outed Netanyahu and Arnon Milchan to the FBI, but they didn't take any answer, any action on it, probably because one of the agents photocopied Who's Who in America, and they realized at what level they were dealing with this smuggling shenanigan.
Well, it's certainly interesting that even though it's out there on your website and you wrote about it for antiwar.com, no other media has picked this up. It's like Netanyahu is like a protected individual. It's extraordinary that even the United States government must know about this, obviously because the FBI had it, and even the presidents would know, but Netanyahu is too powerful a person for a U.S. president to take on. As a matter of fact, he said...
And he proved it because during the Obama administration, he insisted that after Arnon Milchan's long-term resident visa, the State Department wasn't going to renew it. And Netanyahu waded in and actually got his co-conspirator another 10 years on his visa. And so that's just like nuclear weapons. That's real power. And that is actually some of the power that what I would call undue influence that Israel and its lobby are able to swing around because of the nuclear weapons, of the lobby, and of many other aspects to this influence network.
You even describe how the Obama administration, there was a federal gag order issued that said no government employee could speak about this. Tell us about that.
Sure. When President Obama came into office, he was very good on nuclear nonproliferation. In fact, he had a bit of a lesson when Helen Thomas, the White House reporter, asked him about whether there was any country in the Middle East that had nuclear weapons. And he dodged around, but finally said he didn't want to speculate about that. But just a month later, in April of 2009, he called for strengthening the nuclear nonproliferation in a major treaty in the major speech in Prague. But here we have Adam Entos in The New Yorker describing that it only took until the next month for him to yield to this hidden pressure and sign one of these updated letters, the third, promising in not too specific terms, according to Entos, the U.S. would not pressure the Israelis to come clean on their nuclear weapons and wouldn't press them into any conferences or to sign the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. And on September 6th of 2012, his State Department and Department of Energy issued a special secret directive making it a crime for any U.S. government employee or contractor to communicate anything to the public about the Israeli nuclear arsenal, even citing public domain information. And in fact, one person who worked at a national laboratory who cited some public domain information quickly lost his job and really showed that they were serious about prosecuting and punishing anybody who spoke with any level of frankness about this.
It's interesting, the last president to have any courage to speak up on this issue of Israel's nuclear weapons or program was President Kennedy, who not only did he object to that, to Israel developing nuclear weapons, but he also supported uniquely the Palestinian right of return, and as you have written about, demanded that the Israel lobby at that time, the American Zionist Council, register as a foreign agent. This is an amazing web that comes together. Perhaps you could elaborate on that, because nobody else will talk about that failure of the American Zionist Council to register or demand that the lobby register today.
Right. Well, he was very public about being opposed to the what he predicted would be 10 to 20 nations going nuclear before his term ended in 1964, not realizing that it would end much sooner. And he was absolutely the very last pure supporter of non-proliferation, because he was actively working to oppose Israel going nuclear. He was sending over investigators. He was pressuring the Israelis. He was in close consultation with the Atomic Energy Commission. And so he was certainly also cognizant that a lot of fundraising for that program was going on in the United States. He doesn't appear to have known that one of the major Democratic Party fundraisers, Abraham Feinberg, who was also, you know, involved with Truman, he was involved with Kennedy, he was involved with LBJ, was in fact a designated North American fundraiser for the Israeli nuclear program. But he knew how beholden the Democratic Party was to all of this stealth lobbying. And they launched an investigation. They found out there were significant funds coming from Israel into the U.S. political campaign contribution and lobbying infrastructure. And they decided to stop it by making the American Zionist Council, which was an umbrella organization that also had the ZOA as a member of the umbrella, and the American Israel Public Affairs Committee as the lobbying division, unincorporated at that time, ordered them to register as Israeli foreign agents and begin disclosing what they were spending, how they were getting funding, and all of that. And that was November of 1962, and of course a year later, JFK was gone. So there was certainly a very budding understanding that this was major corruption, major subversion of U.S. policy by both Israel and its nascent lobby, but they were unable to do anything about it. And every time they looked over their shoulder, there were people like Abraham Feinberg who knew about the program and who were working against U.S. policy by diving ahead with this effort to proliferate.
In the Samson option, Seymour Hersh wrote about after Feinberg had helped Kennedy win in Illinois, he came to Kennedy's office and told him that now it was time for payback, and he wanted to, according to Hersh's story, to let Feinberg and the Israel lobby write his Middle East policy, and Kennedy was outraged about that afterward and told his staff, not at Feinberg, but afterward. We see a pattern here that goes back many years. You know, we had those hearings that you wrote about in 1963 that Senator Fulbright called. If you hadn't written about them, they'd be literally erased from history because nobody talks about those hearings. Perhaps you could bring us up to date on those.
Sure. Well, the most astounding thing I found out just as a researcher was that these Senate records that, you know, had all of the subpoenaed documents from all of the Israel lobbying organs that were being investigated would never have been public, because the Senate doesn't release their records. You can't actually have a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the Senate because they're not actually under that law. But it was amazing to read the single most important document of that Senate investigation, which was conducted by the Foreign Relations Committee. And it was simply Senator J.W. Fulbright telling his investigative staff that he was extremely concerned about the fact that there seemed to be all of these false flags incidents coordinated between the Israelis and their U.S. lobby that were for the purpose of moving U.S. policy. He mentioned the Lavon affair, which was a false flag bombing attack against U.S. Organizations in Egypt designed to get the U.S. to oppose any nationalization of the Suez Canal. And so he was extremely concerned in secret memos in the Senate archive about what was going on. And that entire investigation, you know, released in 2008, 2010, 67 boxes of material, and we're basically the only ones who were interested enough to put it out there. And there's still microfiche in that archive that hasn't been publicly released, possibly of U.S. intelligence agency observations about what was going on. So this type of information never gets any trajectory in mainstream media. The deeper analysis of the Entaus piece will not happen. And it really is because this is probably one of the single biggest and ongoing scandals in the United States since Teapot Dome or Tammany Hall, you know, the first Republican, the second Democratic Party. And because they're both tied in, tied together and bipartisan in the sense that they traverse Republican and Democratic administrations, there's very little stomach for diving into this and extreme opposition to spreading the word about this. You know, the stories that people submit, the letters to the editors, all these things don't get published. It's one of the huge taboos across the American media to even have any expertise on this information. You're not going to be called by Fox News to deliver that expertise when it's warranted.
I mentioned in my introduction before I called you several stories concerning the U.S.-Israel ties targeting Iran that the mainstream media in the United States has obviously aware of because they're not published on some social media. They're actually published by recognized media, including this extraordinary one last September, which I had actually missed at the time, when they opened a U.S. Air Force Base, Defense Base in Israel, which will be under the command of the Israeli Defense Forces, which means that the U.S. is quite likely, more than likely, to become a partner in the next Israel war in the Middle East. The war would be, of course, of Israel's choosing. What do you think about that?
When I heard about that, the first thing that immediately came to mind is the fact that there's rather active and subtle recruiting of Americans into the Israeli Defense Forces. And so what can happen in the event of major conflicts is that they tend to cycle those American recruits to the front line. And when some inevitably die, that represents a propaganda coup for the Israelis to be able to say, look, you know, American-born Israelis have been killed in the latest action against Hamas in Gaza. And so what I think of when you say that there's a secret U.S. base in the country, I think of them as a tripwire, equal to you, in which their main purpose is to become casualties of any retaliation that comes out of Lebanon or elsewhere against the Israelis for their ongoing military incursions against their neighbors. And so I would assume that that would be the reason for that presence.
Well, I want to go back a moment. I should mention, I forgot to mention about Fulbright, became, I believe, the first member of Congress to be targeted by the Israel lobby for his efforts and putting those hearings together, which obviously very much upset Israel and its supporters of the United States. And, of course, Fulbright is known for his Fulbright scholarships, but and he opposed the Vietnam War. But that element of his career has been totally neglected. And one of your books, Foreign Agents, which is available. By the way, do people get those books from you, or do they go to Amazon, or what's the best way to get them?
We used to sell them directly, but now you can purchase them online in digital or hard copy format. They're available at major chains like Barnes & Noble and Amazon and that sort of thing. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, this kind of information, even among those supporting the Palestinian struggle and criticizing Israeli policy, the hearings are never mentioned, nor the opposition of President Kennedy. It's interesting, Noam Chomsky is a major critic of Kennedy, thinks he was the worst Cold Warrior, despite the fact that evidence that Kennedy's back-channeled communications with Khrushchev kept a nuclear war from happening over the Cuban Missile Crisis. But Kennedy had three different positions that were a red line for Israel. Not only was he against nuclear weapons, Israel developing nuclear weapons, but also, as you mentioned, he tried to get the Israel lobby to register as a foreign agent, which might have been the most dangerous thing for Israel, because then what would have happened had the American Zionist Council been forced to register? How would that have changed the lobbying by Israel in the United States?
Well, it could have actually had the immediate impact of thwarting an operation out of NUMEC, which is a plant in Pennsylvania run by three Zionist Organization of America officials. It could have thwarted their diversion of weapons-grade uranium to the Israelis if the ZOA had to register and if there was increased attention on that particular lobby. AIPAC would never have become what it is today, because if the order had been actually enforced, AIPAC would have provided over 100 reports of its activities on a public website, and all of the three major espionage scandals that they subsequently were involved in, the known ones, wouldn't have happened, and their power would have been greatly diminished. And then there would have been increased attention about whether something else was reconstituting for the Israeli government in under some other nonprofit rubric. But by destroying this investigation and failing to enforce the order that was actually delivered, we have an entirely alternative universe right now where there is this undue influence. And it's amazing to look at the actual record within the Department of Justice investigation, which is at israellobby.org, which is eerily parallel to what's happening with these four presidential letters, where you have all of these major Israel lobbyists and friends of Kennedy coming to him, coming to RFK and coming to the Justice Department saying, no, you need to exercise prosecutorial discretion. You can't even mention that this order has been issued. It's got to be secret. You can't enforce this. You can't force the lobby, even though it's taking all this money, to actually register as a foreign agent, because a foreign agent's registration act shouldn't apply to Israel. And so this incredible pressure to do basically what the presidents have already done, which is make a special exception to the law, promise not to uphold the law, basically throw Americans under the bus.
You made a major effort also to get the Kennedy order finally implemented many years later by going to the FARA with 50-60 pages of documents several years ago, and how did that end up?
That exercise of meeting with the Foreign Agents Registration Act office convinced me that they will not uphold the law. In fact, I asked a former FARA chief who was on C-SPAN at the time why they don't enforce this order, and they just won't even acknowledge it exists. So there's nothing to be done there. We've also challenged this in the courts, in which we presented a case in the D.C. District Court saying, look, U.S. aid is being given to Israel, but Americans are being harmed because all of the information Americans should have access to, such as what is U.S. policy on Israel, you know, threatening Russia. Will the Russians think that the U.S. attacked them? If Israel attacks them, what do they do with the waste? You know, why isn't the Arms Export Control Act being enforced? And basically our argument was that by spending tens of thousands of dollars to get U.S. government information about what Israel and its nuclear program were, that denial was unlawful and harmed us, and that we had spent tens of thousands of dollars trying to get it, and it was denied us. Well, neither the district court nor an appeals court thought that that was sufficient harm to be able to actually challenge aid or challenge the entire unlawful nuclear ambiguity policy that the U.S. has, and they both throwed out the case. So, you know, it's not enough to challenge the Justice Department by going into their public FARA office and complain. The courts apparently are not powerful enough to consider these questions seriously with well-formed cases and well-argued briefs. And so, you know, what's left to be done is to really work to better educate Americans about all of this. The courts produce a lot of information and a lot of horrific Department of Justice claims on the behalf of their defendants on these issues. But 40 to 50% of Americans are extremely concerned about corruption in government. And every one of these articles, every one of these briefs that circulates with some information are some of the most popular and well-circulated things that we put out, because Americans are extremely concerned. They may not be so interested in the intricacies of Middle East policy or follow it as closely as you do or I do, but they are extremely concerned when they see presidents and small interest groups basically shoveling cash into politicians' pockets so that an enormous quality can be shoveled out of the American taxpayer's wallet. So I think awareness is building on these issues, and it's probably another one of the reasons that attendance at these conferences, which are basically, again, focused on corruption more than any particular issue, are growing. People are getting more aware of it every day.
Well, one of the myths that we keep hearing or politicians say is Israel so popular with the American public? We know they're popular with evangelical Christians, but you've conducted polls that show this isn't quite true.
Right. I think Gallup is probably the leading asset in terms of trying to say that Americans are unequivocally sympathetic of Israel. And they've conducted polls for two decades and loudly publicized the results, saying that Americans are unabashedly supportive of Israel and therefore they support the aid. Well, neither of those things is true. We did some directed polling using their same question to Google's multi-million member representative sample, and we found out that more than half of Americans simply hold no opinions on sympathies for Israelis or Palestinians, but that only about 20% of Americans actually hold sympathy for Israelis. And rather than use that as a proxy for American support for Israel in terms of aid, which unfortunately the Congressional Research Service, which puts out a report on U.S. aid to Israel, uses popularity as a proxy for support for aid. That's a report by Jeremy Sharp. What you find out if you ask Americans about whether they think it's much too much, too much, about right, much too little or too little, most Americans feel that U.S. aid to Israel is far too much and would redirect that aid into any number of other more valuable programs, whether it's aiding U.S. veterans, paying down the debt, education. Most Americans would spend it anywhere else but on the Israelis.
We just had an election in New York yesterday in which a pro-Palestinian young Palestinian Latina woman defeated one of the inner circle of the Democratic Party in his attempt to be reelected for another term in Congress. Do you think that has going to have some significance nationwide, because the Democratic Party base, we have heard, actually the papers report, are not as sympathetic to Israel as the older members of the party. And this election, a defeat of a Democratic incumbent who had been considered a possible replacement for Pelosi, must send some waves somewhere. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think it's, I read about that as well. The fact that in that particular election, it was votes and the grassroots that mattered more than money, which can be the case in many, many, many races. I think it's a clear signal that there is absolutely a fracture between the Democratic Party leadership and party bosses, which she was running against a party boss, and that candidate. And this is something that, although Pew Research isn't the gold standard for polling on this either, they did find a massive split in which the Democratic Party base is no longer on the issue of Israel and Palestine. It's very much not in the pocket of Israel and supportive of Israel, pro-Israel policy anymore. So to the extent that a candidate can't just be washed away under a flood of fundraising, this is a very interesting and positive sign.
What are the best ways for people who are interested in the subject, and a number of my listeners have shown they are, to get as much information as possible? On your website, people can watch videos of those conferences over the past. I have to say, you could watch a video of me, because I have spoken in the past at a couple of those conferences.
Absolutely.
And one of them actually has had 8,000 views. My little talk about gatekeepers on the left who don't want to talk about the Israel lobby, which is a major problem. How big a problem is that in the minute we have left?
I think that is a big problem, and I think people should watch your video about gatekeeping on the left, but they should also watch videos about gatekeeping on the right, gatekeeping in other areas, both, you know, diagonal, horizontal, and vertical. But absolutely, people should be following the Twitter feed from IRMEP. They should be looking at antiwar.com, the electronic, any source that is following what's going on with the lobby will provide the context that's mostly missing from the mainstream, and unfortunately even groundbreaking pieces like the MTOWS piece in the New Yorker.
Grant, I want to thank you for being our guest today. The website is irmep.org. It's an Israeli lobby archive for those of you who want to go back into it. And you've written about a half a dozen books, and the most recent, Big Israel, How the Israel Lobby Moves America, it seems very appropriate for our conversation today and for these times and for what we see happening. I want to thank you so much again for being our guest on Takes on the World today, and look forward to the next time.
Much appreciated, Jeff.
Take care.
Bye now.
This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.